The following is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. Please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New York City Skeptics public lecture for August 15th, 2009. Speaking to us today will be Paul Grosswald on Cults and Coercion, How Ordinary People Are Turned into Extraordinary Fanatics. 20 years ago, Paul Grosswald was recruited into the Church of Scientology during his sophomore year at Hofstra University. During 6 months of intense indoctrination, he became increasingly drawn to the group until he ultimately dropped out of school, moved into the cult's Manhattan compound, and signed a 1-billion-year employment contract with Scientology's C organization. After finally breaking free from the cult's influence, he returned to Hofstra, where he earned a BA in communications. Paul has discussed his experience in over 200 lectures and media interviews, in which he educates the public about the dangers of destructive cults and the techniques of coercive persuasion used by cult leaders. Today, Paul is a personal injury attorney who helps victims of destructive cults fight back against their abusers.
Thank you. And let me just remind you again, I handed out those personality inventories. I'm not going to collect them. But if you just take a minute or two and just check off anything on there that applies to you or that ever applies to you, and then I'll refer back to that at a later time. Okay, so my name is Paul Grosswald. I'm a lawyer. I'm a personal injury lawyer. I help the little person fight against corporations or insurance companies or whoever else they need to fight against. And I also help people fight against cults. I got involved in the cult awareness movement because I'm a former Scientologist. When I was in college, way back, a long time ago, about 20 years ago now, I had a brief encounter with Scientology. I was involved in it for about 6 months, which is not a lot of time, but it certainly was long enough to kind of reshape my worldview. The experience caused me to emerge as a skeptic. As somebody who, I'm a much better critical thinker now than I was before I had gotten involved in Scientology. And I use what I learned from that experience to try to help other people who are involved in Scientology or other cults as well. Now, the name of my talk is Cults and Coercion, How Ordinary People Are Turned into Extraordinary Fanatics. And before I begin, I want to make a couple of very important points. First of all, if at any time, if anybody decides that you want to leave, you are free to do so. You can leave any time you want. You're also free to disagree with anything that I say. You are free to challenge any or all of the statements that I make. When we get to the question and answer program, you are part of the program. You are free to ask me whatever question you want to ask me. And as I said, if you don't want to ask it publicly, you are free to write a question down on the index cards and then hand it up to me if you don't feel like publicly asking a certain question. The point is, these are freedoms that anywhere from 5 to 7 million Americans do not have because they are trapped under the influence of destructive cults. There are currently between 3,000 and 5,000 cults operating in the United States. About 180,000 people are recruited into cults every year. So this is a very serious problem. The second point I want to make is that I am not here to attack other people's beliefs. We live in a free society, and people are free to believe and think whatever they want. My concern has to do with the behaviors that certain groups engage in. So, for instance, if somebody wants to believe that they are an alien being from the Markhab Confederation, and that they have been exiled to Earth by an evil intergalactic tyrant named Xenu, that's their business. And if you're a Scientologist, you might very well believe that, and that's your business. But what I am concerned about are the unethical techniques that Scientology uses to get people to believe in Xenu who would not otherwise believe in Xenu but for the unethical and coercive techniques. That's what I'm concerned about. It's bad behavior, not bad beliefs. Another example, if you happen to believe that a Korean businessman named Sun Myung Moon is the Messiah, that's your business. But the techniques that the Moonies use, just like the techniques that Scientology uses and the techniques that all cults use, the techniques that they use are very, very coercive to get people to believe that Moon is the Messiah, even though they would not ordinarily be inclined to believe that. So I think it's important at the outset that I define what I'm talking about when I use the word cult. Now, when I use the word cult, I'm actually referring to destructive cults. And I like to make a distinction between cults and destructive cults. And the reason I make that distinction is that if you look up the word cult in the dictionary, the word cult has a very broad definition. Any group where there's an enthusiastic belief system it could be defined as a cult. I mean, people use the word cult to refer to the people who go to Graceland on Elvis Presley's birthday every year. That's called a cult following, right? People who go to Star Trek conventions are often referred to as being part of a cult following. But that's not the kind of cult followings I'm concerned with. I am concerned with destructive cults. So what is a destructive cult? A destructive cult is a pyramid-shaped organization that is under the control of a charismatic authoritarian leader or leaders. Information in the group is tightly controlled by the leadership and generally flows from the top down. Money in the group generally flows from the bottom up. And the money is raised by membership and generally flows from the bottom up. The group views the world in black and white terms with no shades of gray. It has an us versus them mentality, an ends justifies the means philosophy, and little or no regard for society's laws, ethics, or morals. A destructive cult recruits and retains its members by using deceptive practices and a systematic form of psychological manipulation called mind control. And generally, all eight of Robert J. Lifton's criteria for thought reform will be present in a destructive cult. And I'm going to explain who Robert J. Lifton is and what that means. But you know, Robert J. Lifton identified eight criteria for thought reform, and you will generally have all eight of those criteria in a destructive cult. So who's Robert J. Lifton? Well, he was a psychiatrist back in the 1950s and the 1960s. And he's the one who introduced this concept of brainwashing. He wrote a landmark book called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, a Study of Brainwashing in China. That was published in 1956. And what Robert Lifton did was he analyzed the way in which the communist Chinese were able to change people's minds without their agreement. Right? They're able to get people to accept the communist philosophy without them ever really agreeing to it. And as a result of his analysis, he identified these eight criteria for mind control. And these are the eight criteria. And it's important to understand, because as I said earlier, I'm not criticizing people's beliefs. I'm criticizing their behaviors. These eight criteria are really at the center of those behaviors that I'm criticizing. You know, somebody could have the craziest belief in the world, but if they're not using these eight criteria, if they're not using these eight techniques, I would generally take the position that they're free to have whatever wacky belief they want to have, okay? So these are the eight criteria that distinguish just an ordinary wacky group that has a right to do what they're doing versus a destructive cult that is actually causing harm, which in my opinion should be legally actionable. You know, I should be able to sue the cult for damages. We should be able to prosecute them criminally, although the law doesn't necessarily recognize these eight criteria the way I do. That's why I do these speeches, to try to persuade people. Okay, so these are the eight criteria. The first one is milieu control, control of the milieu, control of a person's environment. The cult exercises complete control over the cult member's environment. The cult controls everything that the cult members see, hear, and experience. All information and communication is filtered by the cult. Okay, so that's the first criteria, milieu control. The second criteria is mystical manipulation. The cult members are manipulated into believing that they are subject to supernatural forces or magical powers beyond their control. The cult leader will often arrange artificial experiences for the members which are designed to appear spontaneous. For instance, a cult leader might create the illusion that cult members are levitating or floating around the room. Because the cult members are unaware of how the cult leader can create such an illusion, they assume that there must be some supernatural explanation for what they're experiencing. I mean, one of the, perhaps the funniest, although it's not really funny because it does serious damage to people, but one of the funniest examples of this is a group called Transcendental Meditation convinces people that they can, that with the power of meditation, they can learn how to fly. And they have people meditate in the yoga, you know, they cross their legs and they sit in the yoga position. And then over time, through the power of suggestion, they start to have spasms in their back and they start to hop along the floor. And then they open their eyes and they realize they're in a different spot when they started, and they think, wow, I flew across the room. And, you know, they've actually, inside the cult, they'll take a photograph of somebody as they're hopping up and then use that to prove that they were flying. Take a still picture of the point when they're at the apex of the jump, and you can see that they're levitating over the ground, but of course it's just a still picture. If you had a moving picture, you would see the person is really just kind of hopping along. They're not really flying. But they create the impression in the minds of the cult members that they can fly, and that they can only fly because they've got the power of the cult and the cult leader, and that if they ever leave the cult, they are not going to be able to fly anymore. So that's an example of mystical manipulation. Okay, so that's technique number two. Number three, the demand for purity. Cult members are given expectations that are impossible to meet. And when they fail to meet those expectations, they're made to feel guilty, ashamed, and inadequate. You always have to do more. You're never good enough to impress the cult leader. You always have to do more. You always have to be more pure. You're having too much outside influence. You need to get rid of the outside influence and purify your thoughts and purify your life in order to achieve salvation or heaven or whatever it is that's being promised by the cult leader. The fourth technique identified by Robert Lifton is confession. Cult members are required to confess their most intimate thoughts and feelings to the group, or at least to the leadership. And this information can be used by the leaders later on to blackmail any cult members who want to leave the group or who challenge the leader's authority. And moreover, the cult members are made to feel guilty and ashamed about the things they confess to, even though the thoughts and feelings they express are usually normal and healthy thoughts and feelings. They're made to feel guilty about perfectly normal feelings that everybody would experience at various points in their life. This ongoing feeling of guilt and shame creates intense emotional and psychological pressure for the cult members, and the cult members end up becoming more dependent on the cult leader, who they then turn to for relief. In other words, they make you feel terrible about yourself, and then you turn to the cult to get help, so you don't feel so terrible anymore. Now, as soon as I mention confession, you know, anybody who's Roman Catholic would immediately go, wait a second, we do confession in the Roman Catholic Church. Are you saying the Roman Catholic Church is a cult? Well, the first thing I want to say about that is is that cultism exists on a continuum. Okay, you can't say that this is a cult and this is not a cult and there's a clear line between the two. There are degrees of mind control and there are degrees of cultism. So a so-called mainstream religion, whether it's Catholicism or Judaism or Protestantism, you know, all of these religions exist on a mind control continuum. There's a certain amount of influence that is being exerted on the members to get them to conform to the religion, okay? But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a destructive cult. It doesn't necessarily mean it's causing the same type of harm. There are people who can be a member of the Catholic Church or a Jewish sect and lead perfectly productive lives and not experience the same kind of psychological damage that a Scientologist or a Mooney might experience. So there's a continuum. But when it comes to confession, I think the big difference with, say, the Roman Catholic Church or some other religions that use confession versus the way a destructive cult uses confession is that in a respectable religion, the confessions are truly confidential. You know, you confess something to the priest has to keep that a secret. The priest is not allowed to divulge that to anybody. And the law even recognizes that there's a privilege for that information, that, you know, the things you confess to your priest in most jurisdictions cannot be used against you. In a cult, when you confess something, there are no limits. I mean, they can use it for, you know, whatever they want. And there are many, many cases of groups that do that. I mean, there was a group called the Boston Movement or the International Church of Christ, where the leaders were compiling a computer database of everyone's confessions, you know. So at any point in time, somebody causes trouble, they can just a few keystrokes away from getting all of the person's secrets, and then they can start pushing that person's buttons and manipulating them. You know, I'm not aware that you know, the Catholic Church does anything on that extent, but, you know, there's always somebody who's going to argue with me on that point. But the point is that there is a degree involved here. Okay, so the first four techniques that Robert Lifton identifies are milieu control, mystical manipulation, demand for purity, and confession. The fifth criteria is the sacred science. The cult leader claims to have special knowledge or powers, and the cult members are expected to accept the leader's claims without questioning. Cult members often feel that they are superior to the outside world because they have access to the ultimate truth. And going back to that example I gave with the transcendental meditation where the people are flying, you know, obviously if you believe that this group has given you the power to fly and levitate, you're going to think that you're superior to everyone in the outside world who doesn't have that same ability. The sixth criteria identified by Robert Lifton is loading the language. The group speaks in a jargon that consists primarily of thought-stopping cliches. These are words or phrases that are designed to shut down the cult members' critical thinking process. You know, ideas, groups, or people that are threatening to the cult leader are given derogatory names or labels, which causes the cult member to become dismissive of such things. You know, some groups will use maybe 20 or 30 buzzwords. Scientology actually produces its own dictionary, and they've got lots and lots of words. And they'll use words like suppressive person. Anybody who criticizes the group is a suppressive person. And so in Scientology, once somebody is labeled as a suppressive person, there's no more credibility anymore, and the Scientologists aren't going to believe anything that that person says. So, for instance, if there are any Scientologists here today, they think I'm a suppressive person, so they can dismiss anything that I say. So rather than actually thinking about the merits of what I'm saying, they will dismiss what I say just because that buzzword, suppressive person, has been attached to me. And that is a way of shutting down the person's thinking. Also, the common jargon that cult members have serves, it's sort of like a secret handshake. You know, when a Scientologist meets another Scientologist and suddenly they're speaking the same language, it's an instant friendship, it's an instant bond because they can communicate. Whereas that same cult member goes home to their family and tries to talk about what they did today, and it makes no sense. The family thinks this person's crazy. What the heck is wrong with you? You're talking about engrams and auditing, and I'll describe Scientology a little later on. But they have all these weird words, and you know, if I came home, you know, if you were my family and I came home and started saying, I got some auditing today, and I reduced some engrams, and it feels great, you'd be looking at me like, what the heck is going on? So it's the language divides the Scientologist or the cult member from their family and from their friends and causes them to become more united with the other people in the group. The seventh technique identified by Robert Lifton is doctrine over person. The group's agenda and the ideology are more important than any one individual member of the group. So if a cult member has an idea or an experience which contradicts the group's sacred science, the cult member must reinterpret those ideas and those experiences to make them fit the cult's agenda, okay? Because the cult can never be wrong, okay? And then finally, Lifton talks about the dispensing of existence. The group has an us versus them view of the world, where cult members believe that outsiders are evil and do not have the right to exist. Cult members become afraid to leave the group out of fear that they will lose their right to exist as well, okay? And this is when you get the really scary stuff, where people start believing in genocide or start believing it's okay to kill other people or strap a bomb on you and blow yourself up and kill innocent people because we, in the cult, have the right to decide who gets to exist, and we don't have to respect society's laws or morals. We can decide because we have God on our side. We can decide whether you get to live or die, and that's when you start getting into, you know, terrorism and violent groups and groups that really, really cause a lot of harm to people. So now if you have these eight criteria, I'll just go through them again just to reinforce them. You know, milieu control, mystical manipulation, demand for purity, confession, sacred science, loading the language, doctrine over person, and dispensing of existence. When you have all of these things operating in a single environment, the effects on a cult member can be devastating. Most cult members will experience a sudden personality change, which can involve drastic changes in behavior, thoughts, emotions, and worldview. The personality change is often marked by a sudden change in their lifestyle goals and their interests. Cult members will often abandon their career paths and their relationships that existed prior to the cult involvement. The sudden personality change also causes cult members to develop difficulty in communicating with their friends and family members outside the cult. One of the hallmarks of a mind control situation is the process of phobia indoctrination. What happens is a cult member is instilled with phobias. They're made to become irrationally afraid of anything that challenges the cult or the cult's mindset. So the cult member becomes afraid that bad things are going to happen to them if they ever leave the group or if they ever disobey the leadership. You know, for instance, some cult members are told that they will become possessed by the devil if they ever leave the group. Others are told they will get sick and die. The intense fear that cult members experience will cause psychological paralysis, and it will cause them to lose the ability to form the decision to leave the group. And so this is why I distinguish cults from just your run-of-the-mill, wacky group. The defining characteristic of the cult is that the cult member cannot form the decision to leave because of this phobia indoctrination. They become afraid. You know, in the Moonies, they have a saying in the Moonies, Satan works through the ones you love. So your mother and father and your brother and sister, your wife, your husband, your children, the people who love you are going to be possessed by Satan, and Satan will use them to tempt you to turn your back on Reverend Moon. So your family now becomes the enemy. So, you know, the Moonies would argue, well, if people make a free choice to join the Moonies, then that's protected under the First Amendment, and we should respect that choice. But it's one thing if somebody makes a choice to join the Moonies because they've, you know, thought about it and they know what it is they're getting involved in. But when somebody has been, you know, subjected to intense hypnosis and then indoctrinated to believe that their family and friends are evil, and now it's out of fear they're being coerced into joining a group, now I think you've got a different situation. And, of course, it becomes a problem of proof in many cases. I mean, how do you prove that somebody's doing something because they've been, you know, coerced or made afraid as opposed to, you know, they made their own independent free choice? But certainly, when you have an environment like what you have in a cult situation where all the information is being controlled and all the communication is being controlled, and then people start developing these fears, I think you could certainly make a case that they're doing something that is very unethical and something that should be illegal, although in most cases, in the United States anyway, it's not illegal. Other countries, you know, in Europe in particular, have actually passed quite a few laws that make cult activity illegal. But in the United States, it's very hard for those laws to survive, you know, First Amendment scrutiny because we have the law has such respect for freedom of religion. But I would argue there's no freedom of religion if you're being, you know, hypnotized against your will, which in effect is what's going on here. So the question is, what kind of people would get involved in groups like this? What kind of people get involved in cults? I want you to take a look at those personality self-inventories that I handed out. And I asked you to check off how many of these items apply to you or have ever applied to you. I am considered bright in most things. I'm a curious person about the world around me. I've been a leader among my friends at school and during extracurricular activity. This is actually geared for college, but if you're an adult, you could. I've been a leader among my business peers. I've been a member of a group and consider myself a follower. I have moments when I doubt myself and my ability to succeed. I'm afraid of the future from time to time. I'm considered idealistic by not my parents, if you're young, if you're older. I'm considered idealistic by my friends, my family. Number 8, I enjoy being liked by those I like, and I enjoy receiving compliments from them. And number 9, I sometimes like taking risks. All right, how many people checked off at least 3 of those as things that apply to you or have ever applied to you? All right, that's just about everybody in the room is raising their hand. And that's the point, is that those of you who've checked off 3 or more of these items, you are exactly the type of people that cult recruiters are looking for. That's just about everybody in the room. And that's an important point because I think a lot of people have a stereotype that there's a certain type of person that gets involved in a cult or a certain type of person that's targeted, and I'm not that type of person, and my kid is not that type of person, and my friend is not that type of person. We are all the type of people that cult recruiters are looking for. We all have characteristics that the cult will find valuable. But not everybody is going to get recruited into a cult. Why do some people get recruited and other people don't? It comes down to only one thing, and this is probably the most important thing I'm going to say in this entire presentation. Occult recruitment comes down to the timing. It all comes down to the timing. That's the single most important determining factor, is the timing. Nobody leads a charmed life. We all go through points in our life when we're vulnerable. We might lose a job. We might have a death in the family. We might move to a new place. For young people, starting college is a transition that can be very difficult, or failing a test. For older people, going into retirement or having a divorce can be a very stressful thing. Or having your kids leave home and suffering from the empty nest syndrome. All of these life transitions can make us vulnerable. And if the right cult recruiter comes along with the right message at the right time, anybody can be taken in. Anybody can be taken in. Unless, of course, you're somebody who knows what to look for, which is why these presentations that I do, I feel, are so important. Now, this group is a group of skeptics. So I imagine that this particular group probably already has a certain amount of training in how to think critically by virtue of the fact that you're involved in a skeptics group, and every month there's another speaker coming forward, either debunking this or educating you about that. But, outside of the skeptics community, I think there's a lack of critical thinking training that takes place in schools, in high schools, and in colleges. And because of that, people who become vulnerable, people who go through these emotional points in their life when they're vulnerable, people who go through these difficult transitions, often don't have the tools they need to deal with the stress. Or they don't have the tools they need to analyze occult recruitment when it's happening to them. And as a result, people end up getting taken in. The first step in a cult recruitment process is the cult recruiter has to get you into a mind control environment, right? If I come up to you on the street and I try to, convince you and, to do some auditing or to reduce your engrams, as a Scientologist would try to get you to do, it's kind of hard to get you to just do that when you're in your own environment and you've got your own life and your own chores to do. And, why would you want to come with me? But if I can get you into a mind-control environment, if I can get you into a place where I can control all of your experiences, now I might be able to reach you. So the first thing the cult recruiter tries to do is to get you into their environment. Now, they're not going to say to you, hey, I'm a cult recruiter, I want you to come into my mind-control environment. So what they do is they often will set up front groups, or they'll set up a pretext, well, some justification to get you into their environment. For instance, the Moonies are very good at this. The Moonies actually have quite a number of front groups and businesses. And the front group doesn't have to be, the front group could be a legitimate business, right? I mean, you could be, working for the Washington Times newspaper as a journalist. Turns out it's owned by the Moonies, and many Moonies work there. And in the course of your job, you get approached by your coworkers who invite you to go to a seminar or to a party at someone's house, and it turns out it's a Mooney recruiting event. So you can be recruited anywhere. You can be recruited, you can have something as benign as the chess club on a college campus could be run by cult members as a way to try to, lure people in. I don't want people to become afraid to ever join any group. It's not, my message is not that everybody could be an evil cult, so stay away from everybody. Don't ever do anything. That's not my message. But my message is you've got to be skeptical. You've got to ask a lot of questions. If you're going to join something, if you're going to give money to something, you got to know what it is, and you got to ask questions. And if the people you're asking questions of, if they're legitimate, they will welcome the questions. If they're not legitimate, if they make you feel bad that you're asking questions, that's a warning sign that you should probably go in another direction. But just to show you how sophisticated these cults can be, there's a private investigator named Larry Ziliox who compiled a list of front groups for the Moonies. And so this involves organizations that the Moonies use to recruit. It involves businesses that they own. And it's got a lot of different. It covers all 50 states and actually a number of different countries around the world. And just to get an idea of how sophisticated, these are the groups affiliated with one cult. So it's not just a cult, it's a conglomerate. It's a major enterprise. So that's just one cult. I mean, if I gave you the Scientology list, that would also be about equally as long. So you get the idea. And you're never going to be able to memorize all the things on this list. So that's why those eight criteria of mind control identified by Robert Lifton are so important. You know, I could sit here and give you the names on the list and say, avoid these groups, but then by tomorrow they'll change their names and a different cult will come along that I didn't mention, and you can still get recruited. So it doesn't do any good to try to track all the names of all the different cults. What you want to do is be aware of the eight Robert Lifton mind control criteria that no matter what group you're in, whether it's on a list you've seen before or not, if you can recognize those criteria when it's happening to you, then you're much, much more likely that you're going to recognize that you're being recruited into a cult. So let me give you one more example of what Scientology does. This is the Scientologist Guide to Dissemination, basically their recruiting manual. And just to show you, it says in here, now remember how I said that cults try to recruit you when you're vulnerable, right? So Scientology has a four-step recruiting drill. And step number three of the recruiting drill is finding a ruin. They train their recruiters to find a ruin in the person they're recruiting, which is the Scientology way of saying, find what's bothering the person. And when you find what's bothering the person, then you can promise to address that need to lure them in. And on the next page of the recruiting manual is the chart of common ruins. And so in this column, you've got all the common problems that people have in life. No goals or direction in life, job instability, depression and anxiety, unhappy relationships, marriage problems, study problems, you know, common problems that people have, right? And then in the next column, these are the L. Ron Hubbard, he's the cult leader. He's dead, but he's still the cult leader. These are the L. Ron Hubbard books to read. If you have this problem, you can read this L. Ron Hubbard book. This is an L. Ron Hubbard lecture that you can attend or listen to on audio tape. Here's an L. Ron Hubbard film to see. And these are the Scientology courses you can take that will address each of these problems. So whatever problem you have, Scientology has an answer for you. Now, think about how this plays out, okay? Suppose you meet somebody, a friend of yours, or you know somebody who you trust and comes along, and you mention to them, you know, I'm having a lot of trouble in my marriage. You know, I don't know. We need marriage counseling. And your friend says, hey, you know, it's funny you should say that because this, I'm involved in Scientology and they have this great course, this marriage course that you should take, okay? So you go in, you take the course, and now you're in the mind control environment, you get sucked into the cult, and then sometime later on, you run into me, the suppressive person. And I'm trying to explain to you how this recruiting, it's all very manipulative and they're just pushing your buttons and all that stuff. And now you're going to say to me, what are you going to say to me? You're going to say, oh, come on. How could the recruiter have been manipulating me? They didn't know that I was going to tell them that I had a marriage problem, right? They invited me to this marriage course. It was just a coincidence that the marriage course was being given at that same time that I said I had a marriage problem. You know, they didn't know I was going to say that, so how could they have planned it, right? But what you don't realize is they've got a chart. So whatever you say, there's a course being offered. So if you hadn't said marriage, if you had said something else, you would have been given a different course. So as the person being recruited, you feel like it's spontaneous. You feel like you're having a spontaneous experience. You don't realize that the experience is actually being scripted and planned out for you. That's the mystical manipulation that that Lifton talks about. You know, you feel like, wow, it's... Here I was in the downtrodden part of my life, and all of a sudden, Scientology was there, totally spontaneous. But it's not spontaneous. You're being manipulated, and that's what people don't realize. So, having given you all that background, I now want to tell you my personal story about what happened with me in Scientology, and then after that we'll have some questions and answers. Basically, I got involved in Scientology back in the fall of 1989. I was a sophomore at Hofstra University, and you know, I was going through all the typical teenage angst that people go through. You know, I was I was having trouble with girls, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to major in, and just going through all the typical teenage angst. And one day, I had come into New York City, and somebody on the street handed me this. Are you curious about yourself? Right? Yes, as a matter of fact, I am. I am curious about myself. So it's a free personality test, a 200-question questionnaire, and they say if you fill it out, we can analyze your personality for you absolutely free. Okay, so I filled it out, I mailed it in, and then a few days later, I get a phone call inviting me to come in to get the results of the personality test. Well, so now I'm in their mind control environment, okay? And so now they give me this personality test reading, and again, here's mystical manipulation. I came out of there feeling like, wow, that was the most incredible personality analysis ever. They know everything about me. These guys are geniuses. Wow, you know? And of course, in retrospect, I figure out, you know, I figured out since, you know, how they do it. And if you really want to know how they do it, a great example is James Randi does this. He doesn't do it with the Scientology personality test, but he does it when he's explaining, when James Randi's explaining horoscopes. Has anybody ever heard James Randi explain how horoscopes work? Gives out a horoscope to everybody and says, read this, and then tell me how accurate you think it is. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, it's a 4 out of 5. It's a 5 out of 5. It's really accurate. And then James Randi says, take your horoscope and give it to the person next to you. And it's the same exact horoscope. And everyone's like, whoa. It was really just a very generically written thing that applies to everybody, but you think it applies to you, and you interpret it as if it was a hit. You remember all the hits, you forget all the misses, and you come away thinking it was a really accurate horoscope reading, when in fact it was just a generic one that could have applied to anybody. Well, so the personality test works the same way as the horoscope. They gave me a generic 18-year-old personality reading. You're not sure what you want to do with the rest of your life. You have trouble with girls. You're socially awkward. Well, you know, sitting there in the chair, like the guy could look at me and tell I'm socially awkward, right? You know? So... You know, so they come up with these very generic things, but I believe that there was some credibility to this. So then once they convinced me that I had problems with my personality, the next thing for them to do was to tell me that they can help solve these problems. All I have to do is take the L. Ron Hubbard Dianetics Seminar. It's only $95, and if you don't like it, we'll give you your money back, right? No risk at all. Why not give it a try? Now, a couple of things to keep in mind. First of all, they didn't mention the words church or Scientology. This was the L. Ron Hubbard Dianetics Foundation, and the personality test actually didn't say Scientology either. It said L. Ron Hubbard Dianetics Foundation. So right away, there's deception involved. They're not telling me it's a church. You know, here I am, a nice Jewish boy from Long Island. What would I be doing joining a church, right? So they're telling me that the Hubbard Dianetics Seminar can solve my problems. And you know, my parents raised me to be open-minded. I'm the kind of person who wants to try new things. So what's the harm? You know, all I have to do is pay $95, give it a try, see what happens. There's no risk. If I don't like it, I can always leave. See, I didn't understand about the mind control. I didn't understand about the phobia indoctrination or the mystical manipulation. I didn't realize that once I agreed to go along on this process, they were going to start to do things to my mind that would undermine my ability to make a decision to leave. And that's what I didn't realize. I assumed I can always leave any time, so there's no risk. There's no danger here. And so I agreed to take the Hubbard Dianetics Seminar. And on the seminar, they began teaching me about the basic principles of Scientology. And the first thing they taught me was this concept that they call auditing. Now, auditing is really a subtle form of hypnosis. And when I use the word hypnosis, people have a lot of misunderstandings about what that means. You know, I think people assume that hypnosis is when you swing a watch in front of somebody's face and put them into a deep sleep, and then they act like a chicken on stage, and it's really funny. But hypnosis can be a lot more subtle than that. Hypnosis is really a state of focused concentration. And in that state of mind, your critical thinking skills slow down, and you become more suggestible. You become susceptible to suggestions. The things that are said to you can start to influence the way your mind creates memories, and your imagination starts to kick in, and the way you perceive the world can be reshaped when you're in that hypnotic state. But I never, you know, fell asleep or lost consciousness, so I didn't realize that this is what was actually going on. And it's important to understand, if they had said to me that they were going to hypnotize me, I could have resisted very easily. You know, anybody can resist hypnosis if you know you're being hypnotized. But what happens is, because they don't tell you that that's what they're doing, people don't know that there's danger and they don't know to resist. So they end up hypnotizing you with your own consent. So it's not that people who get involved in these cults are weak-minded. It's not that they're overpowered by the hypnosis because they're so weak-minded. They're willingly going along because they've been coerced into going along under false pretenses. So, and that's important to understand, is that a lot of times the brainwashing happens with the cult member's own cooperation. And of course, that also creates legal difficulties as well. If the cult member then tries to sue later on for damages, the cult leader says, but you cooperated. You didn't have to do it. I didn't put a gun to your head. Nobody made you do all this stuff. But that doesn't mean they weren't coerced into it. So here's what happens with the auditing. Scientology says that all of your problems are caused, or Dianetics says, because I didn't know about Scientology yet. Dianetics says that all of your problems are caused by things that have happened to you in the past. So all of these, if something good happens to you in your past, it will form a good memory. But if something bad happens to you in your past, it will form an engram. An engram is sort of like an evil memory. It constantly re-stimulates and undermines your ability to do well in life. So the key to succeeding in life is to remove these engrams from your mind. And the way you do that is by confronting them. So in Scientology, they'll have you do an auditing session where if I'm auditing, I'll be sitting in a room and there's another person across the table, about a few feet away from me. That's the auditor. I'm the PC, or the pre-clear, because I'm not yet clear of my engrams. And the auditor will tell me to think of something I want to talk about. So suppose I remember having a fight with my mother when I'm 10 years old. So I'll talk about that. And I'll talk about it and talk about it. And when I'm done talking about it, the auditor will tell me to go back and talk about it again. And you repeat the same story over and over again. And each time, the auditor tells you to focus on more details. Come up with more details. What does the room smell like? What is your mother wearing? Now, I can't possibly remember any of those details, but what happens is your imagination takes over, and you start filling in the details. And because at the time, I was not a skeptic, and I didn't understand how human memory works, I thought that everything I remembered was accurate. I didn't realize that my memory could play tricks on me. So you start remembering things that aren't necessarily accurate. And then things start becoming emotional. So that, you know, I might have had a fight with my mother when I'm 10 years old, which in my current life has no bearing on anything. But when you start focusing on it and you start concentrating on, you put yourself in the scene, you get upset, you get angry, you start to cry. This minor incident is now being blown up out of proportion. And in my mind, it's, you know, here I am like crying in tears over this relatively minor incident. And because I'm suggestible, because I'm being hypnotized, these distorted memories now become seared into the consciousness. So your perception starts to change. So a person can start to, you know, a person who had a great relationship with somebody prior, after a while starts focusing on all these bad things and starts blowing them out of proportion, and that can start to make them change the way they feel about that relationship, right? You know, so, you know, over time, my parents eventually became suppressive persons, right? Once they started criticizing Scientology, they became suppressive persons, which is absurd because, you know, I had a great childhood. You know, I'm one of these people who, you know, parents were always together, parents always loved each other, you know, never had any, you know, any abuse in my life or anything like that, you know. So there's really no rational reason for me to ever feel that my parents are suppressive persons, but eventually that's what it turned into. And as you go through these auditing sessions, I mean, after maybe the first couple of weekends, I started having these mystical experiences. You know, you talk about something and you're really emotional and you're crying. And then after a while, you get a release. You get to the point where I would just break out laughing hysterically. You know, I'd get a euphoric high, you know. Basically, it's just, you know, I'm not enough of a brain expert to be able to explain scientifically why it happens. But I can tell you the gist of it is it's a chemical reaction. You know, once you have this intense emotional reaction in your head, eventually endorphins are going to be released and you're going to start to feel that pleasure that you get. You know, if you've ever had a really intense crying spell and then you're done with it and you get that feeling of relief afterwards, it's just a chemical reaction in the brain. But I interpret that experience as I've reduced an engram. It's proof that Scientology really works. Again, mystical manipulation. They're orchestrating this experience in me, and then when they give me the experience, they also give me the interpretation of the experience. This is proof that you've reduced an engram. So now I start believing in it. So it's important to understand that. I think a lot of people like look at, you know, Scientologists or other cult members and think, these people must be really stupid. How could they be dumb enough to fall for that? Don't they really? And what you don't realize is there's this emotional manipulation taking place. There's these, you know, chemical reactions being manipulated in your brain that are being seared into your consciousness, and it really does affect the way you view the world. So a person who previously would not be willing to accept this belief system is now suddenly open to receiving it. It's coercive, and it's, you know, it's sinister. And this is, you know, this is why I personally believe, you know, there should be a cause of action. There should be I think Scientologists should be allowed to sue for damages. But, you know, absent physical abuse or clear intentional infliction of emotional distress, it's often very, very difficult for Scientologists to bring lawsuits or former Scientologists to bring lawsuits. But once you start to develop an understanding of what they're doing, you start to see this isn't right. You know, it's one thing to stand on a street corner and say, I believe in this, do you want to join my church, and then give people a free choice to join or not join. But when they start hypnotizing you against your will and they start putting you through this emotional coercion, I think they're crossing the line. Okay, so the auditing, that's the auditing. There are five things that Scientology does very early on, which are constantly reinforced throughout a Scientologist's career. The auditing is the first of these five things. But all five of these things are designed to get a person's mind to shift into a different paradigm, into a different way of thinking, so that the Scientology mindset can be instilled into them. So auditing is one. The second thing Scientology does is something they call TRs, or training routines. And a training routine is basically Scientology says, and a lot of what cults do is based in truth. They'll take a little bit of truth and then take it to an extreme. Scientology very truthfully and honestly says that to improve your life, you've got to be good at communicating. Communication is an important life skill that you have to have. Okay, nobody would dispute that. But then they take it to a whole new level by defining communication in a way that no rational person would define it. They basically say that to communicate, you have to be comfortable confronting another person. So the way they get you to confront another person is they have you sit in a chair facing another person, staring at them like this. Now you laughed over here. See, if you laugh, the supervisor, the coach who's supervising the course, is going to say, flunk. You have to do it again until you can sit here without laughing, without flinching, you know. And that's, they would discourage you from blinking, although realistically, people do blink, although it depends. It's got to be a subtle blink. If it's a flinch, no good. It's got to, you know. I think I was going long times without blinking at times. I mean, I was, you know, when I first started doing this, I was doing it for maybe about 10 minutes at a time. But after 6 months, I was doing this for 3 hours straight. I mean, they actually had me do this for 3 hours, just staring at another person here, 3 hours without moving. You know, this is not teaching me to communicate. This is teaching me to shut my mind off. That's what it is. It's basically putting me into a perpetual hypnotic trance. And they're teaching me to go into a trance whenever I'm confronting somebody that I don't want to confront. So that when my parents would start asking me questions about Scientology, the response would be like this. You know, they couldn't get through. So, again, it's very sinister. They make it seem like, oh, we're just teaching people to communicate. And, you know, Tom Cruise and John Travolta will say that, you know, Scientology has helped them learn to communicate. But they don't tell you, you know, if anybody ever asked Tom Cruise to explain how exactly do they teach you to communicate? What are the exercises they're giving you? Well, first of all, he wouldn't answer you. But if you can ever get him to answer you, it would be very strange indeed, because there's no communication involved here. They're teaching you to shut your mind off. Okay, so those are the TRs. And of course, they have more advanced TRs. They eventually have one called bull baiting. Bull baiting is where, you know, the initial TR is when you're standing there, you're sitting there, and somebody's just sitting back without doing anything. With bull baiting, the other person is now allowed to say or do anything they want, short of physically touching you, anything they want to try to get a reaction out of you. And you have to sit here and take whatever abuse they give you, okay? Now, keep in mind, if you're doing it with somebody who's higher up, who has access to your, you know, confessional files, and they know all your secrets, they can use all that stuff against you, and you have to just sit there, you know, without reacting. Okay, so this is a way of really, you know, breaking you down and getting you to the point where you're just not able to think critically anymore at all. The third thing Scientology does is study tech or study technology. Scientology claims, and again, it doesn't sound bad when you hear it, that you got to be able to study well, to do well in school, to do well in business, to do well in life. You've got to be able to study information and process it well. Okay, fine. No argument there. But then when you learn the techniques that they use to actually bring this about, you can see the problem. There are three elements to study tech. The first one is word clearing, okay? Word clearing is when, you know, you're studying a material, you know, I'm reading a Scientology book, and the supervisor, the person supervising the Scientology class will point to a word, and I have to define that word. And if I can't define that word, I have to go get a definition of it, use it in a sentence, prove I understand the word before I can go on and read any more, right? Because Hubbard says the only reason a person ever misunderstands a subject they're studying is because they went past a misunderstood word. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, you may not know a word exact, you may not know the exact definition of a word, but you can tell from context. If you're a thinker, you can often figure out what the word is from context. But Hubbard says, no, if you don't understand something, it's because you went past a word you didn't understand. So you end up going on these crazy wild goose chases, trying to define the word if, trying to define just ridiculous things. And of course, Scientology has their own jargon and their own dictionary. So they're using words that aren't even real words, and you have to define them using the Scientology definition, which of course doesn't make any sense. You know, so the language is really meant to confuse you. And what happens is, what happened to me is I started becoming dependent on them because I started thinking, this is so confusing. How come, you know, I was an honor student in high school, and all of a sudden I'm not smart enough to figure this out. You know, what's wrong with me? Help me figure this out. You know, I got to work harder to figure this out. You know, it didn't occur to me to say, hey, these guys are idiots, and they're teaching nonsense. That's why it doesn't make sense. You know, because I already believed, because I already had the mystical experiences with the engrams being reduced, and I already believed in it, I just assumed, all right, I'm missing something. It's, it can't be there. They're not the ones who are idiots. I'm the idiot. I got to, you know. And so I would become dependent on them. Okay, so that's word clearing. The second thing they do with study tech is they call this reducing objects to mass. Okay, Hubbard says that in order to study an object or study a topic, you have to be able to reduce the topic to mass. And the example he gives is if you're trying to teach somebody how to use a camera, if you simply describe all the different buttons and all the different features, the person's not going to get it. But if you give them the camera and let them play with the buttons and see what it can do, they're going to learn it a lot faster. Okay, that makes perfect sense. But then try applying that to teaching abstract ideas. You know, try explaining political theory by reducing it to mass. Try explaining human emotions or concepts like love or ethics. You know, those aren't tangible concepts. But in Scientology, you have to reduce everything to mass. And so when you're in a Scientology course room, they'll have little gadgets on the table, like paper clips and clay and pens and things that you can use to do demonstrations. So whatever it is you're studying, you know, you'd say, well, this, you know, if I was learning about the suppressive person, concept in Scientology, basically Scientology says that, you know, if you're connected to a suppressive person, they're going to interfere, they're going to cause you to become a potential trouble source. And if you're a potential trouble source, you're not allowed to advance in Scientology anymore. So if I was going to demo that, you know, this might be the, this water bottle might be the suppressive person. The pen is me, the potential trouble source. You know, this is Scientology. And then I would explain to the course supervisor that this suppressive person is standing between me and Scientology. So I have to disconnect my relationship with the suppressive person so I can get back into Scientology. So basically you're doing all these like demonstrations with objects. And this is a very stilting process, you know. You know, it's nice to be able to think with words, where you can develop long, complex, flowing thoughts with language. But when you have to reduce everything to like little objects, it really stilts your higher level thinking. And it causes your thinking level to be reduced to the level of a child. I mean, you can't really do sophisticated, complex thinking when you have to, you know, map it all out with with all these little objects. So it's that's another thing that they do to try to, you know, break you down and get you into a childlike state. And the third aspect of study tech is the gradient doctrine. Scientology says that you have to learn on a gradient. Makes sense, right? I mean, you wouldn't go to a fifth grade student and give them seventh grade math because it'll be too hard for them, right? You do fifth grade math in fifth grade, and then when they're in sixth grade, they do sixth grade math. Okay, fine. But Scientology abuses the gradient concept. And what Scientology does is they use the gradient concept to control information. In other words, you're not ready to learn about this other piece of information because you're not at that level yet. You'll learn when it's time. When we're ready to give you the information, we'll give it to you. So this gradient doctrine is used as a legitimate excuse to hide information from the members in the group. And again, this is another clear distinction between a destructive cult and some wacky group, a mainstream religion, which is not necessarily a cult. You know, when a group is hiding information, in my mind, that's a fraud. That should be illegal. You're in a group, you have a right to know what's going on. I mean, within reason. I mean, you know, certain information may be proprietary information, but certainly a religion's belief system is not proprietary information, right? Scientology hides its upper-level belief system from the lower members of the group, so the lower members of the group don't even really know what the group believes. That Xenu doctrine I mentioned earlier, most Scientologists don't even know about Xenu because they haven't attained that level yet, okay? And that, I think, is, or should be, criminal. Okay, so I said earlier that Scientology does five things that I have a real problem with. The first was auditing, the second was TRs, the third is study tech. The fourth is disconnection, which I just demonstrated for you, the disconnection policy, that if you're connected to somebody who's critical of Scientology, you're encouraged to disconnect from them, and you're not allowed to advance in Scientology until you disconnect from them. There are many, many families that have been destroyed. Marriages have broken apart. Children who can't see their parents and parents not being allowed to talk to their children, all because of this disconnection policy. Scientology is fearful of any love relationship that you have. If there's somebody who cares about you, that's a threat to the leadership. They want you to separate from anyone who loves you so that the cult leader is the only one that you're going to have any relationship with. Okay? That is a very, very dangerous and very, very destructive policy. The fifth thing Scientology does that I have a problem with, I mean, among other things, is something called ethics cycles, okay? Basically, any time a Scientologist does or says anything to suggest that they are not totally dedicated to Scientology, the Scientologist will be referred to an ethics officer. And the ethics officer will require the Scientologist to undergo an ethics cycle. And the more serious the Scientologist's departure is from expected behavior, the more intense and time-consuming the ethics cycle will be. So an ethics cycle usually begins with an interrogation by the ethics officer. So if the ethics officer is satisfied that all the non-orthodox thinking has been eliminated from the Scientologists, then the ethics cycle will probably end quickly. More often than not, however, the ethics cycle will take hours or days or weeks or even months. Now, to understand this, let me just give you some background in the Scientology belief system. They claim that there are 10 ethics conditions in life. So at any given point in time, a person will always be in one of these 10 conditions. And these conditions are arranged in a hierarchy from lowest to highest. And so the goal for any Scientologist is to always be in the highest ethics condition possible, right? Okay, so for each condition below the highest condition, there's a step-by-step formula which, if the Scientologist follows that formula, it will enable them to come out of their condition and move up to the next condition, okay? And when you're in the highest condition, there's a step-by-step formula which, if the Scientologist follows it, will enable the Scientologist to demonstrate to other Scientologists how to remain in that highest condition. So there's always these formulas that you're supposed to go through, okay? Now, these ethics cycles generally consist of a process of denigration, intimidation, incrimination, and humiliation. This is where they really, really break the Scientologist down. The process creates a great deal of emotional and psychological stress for the Scientologist and causes their critical thinking abilities to be shut down. And this, in turn, causes the person's resistance to Scientology to break down. And ultimately, after a successful ethics cycle, a Scientologist will be unquestioningly devoted to Scientology and ready to obey the leader's commands. So let me just give you an example of this. A common situation where a Scientologist might be required to undergo an ethics cycle would be if the Scientologist decided to skip a day of Scientology coursework so that they could pursue some other non-Scientology activity, such as, say, attending an acting audition. Okay, somebody's an actor and they want to attend an audition, so they miss their Scientology coursework for that day. So the Scientologist will be asked to account to the ethics officer as to why they were not on course that day. The ethics officer will accuse the Scientologist of being out ethics or in a low ethics condition. And the ethics officer will demand that the Scientologist undertake the appropriate ethics formulas to get into a higher ethics condition. And in such a situation, the Scientologist will often claim, they did nothing wrong. I just went to an acting audition because, you know, it's my job. And, you know, I have dreams of becoming an actor and I was just pursuing my dreams. So the Scientologist doesn't think that they did anything wrong. Well, the Scientologist will often be accused of having committed crimes against Scientology. The Scientologist will be required to confess those crimes. If the Scientologist has nothing to confess, they will usually be pressured to come up with something, okay? The Scientologist will be required to make these confessions while hooked up to an e-meter, which is a primitive lie detector device. It's basically two cans connected to a battery, and when you hold these cans, it sends an electrical charge through your body. You don't feel the charge. It's not a strong electrical current, but if you have an emotional response, if you get nervous or agitated, the electrical current in your body will change and the needle will move. It's a skin galvanometer, something invented, you know, 100 years ago or so. But Hubbard claimed that he invented this thing. And when the needle moves, they claim that's proof of an engram, or it's proof that you're hiding something, or it's proof of whatever. It could just be, you know, you could have indigestion and the needle will move. I mean, it's meaningless. But the Scientologists believe that this is going to catch them if they lie, so they believe that they have to tell the truth. So when a Scientologist is questioned on the e-meter, it's called a security check or a sec check. And a sec check can be very, very intimidating for the Scientologist. The Scientologist will often be attacked with questions from multiple people in the room who direct their questions to the Scientologist in an accusatory tone. And because the Scientologist, remember, is in a highly suggestible state, because they're constantly undergoing these hypnotic exercises, they're doing the auditing, they're doing the TRs, right? With the word clearing, they have to constantly read the same passages over and over again to clear all their words. And that also is something that puts you into a hypnotic trance, just a constant reading over and over and over again. So the Scientologist is highly suggestible, and as a result, the Scientologist's imagination becomes malleable. And eventually, their imagination takes over, and sooner or later, they have something to confess. The Scientologists will often end up confessing things they never really did, or, you know, in the extreme case, eventually what happens to most Scientologists is they start thinking of things that happened in a previous lifetime. And this is where the Scientology belief system starts getting really bizarre, is that with the auditing and with the ethics cycles, people start to remember being in places where they've never been before. And this even happened to me at one point. I thought I remembered, you know, being in my crib or having some really early memory. There's no way I could have that kind of a memory. But your imagination becomes malleable when you're under hypnosis and you're suggestible. And so suddenly, you know, there I was in Scientology. All my friends and people that I trust are telling me that they can remember their past life experiences. What's wrong with me? I'm the only one here who can't remember my past life experiences. So instead of thinking that they were crazy, I started thinking that I must be crazy. Something's wrong with me. That, you know, I got to study Scientology even harder so I can get up to the same level that all of these other people are at. So after a while, your imagination takes over and you start remembering these things, and people start remembering things. And under hypnosis, you can't really tell the difference between a real memory and your imagination. You know, the Scientologist has these memories that are so vivid, they think they're real, and they lose the ability to distinguish. They're basically becoming psychotic. They're becoming delusional. They're losing touch with reality, but they can't tell. And the reason why most people who are not Scientologists think Scientologists are crazy is because Scientologists are, to some degree, crazy. But because they have these crazy ideas. But if you're a Scientologist, you don't think you're crazy. You think that all the non-Scientologists are crazy because, you know, here you are with a memory that is so vivid, and what's wrong with you that you can't remember it? It would be like if I tried to convince you that you weren't sitting here in this library today. You're not in the library. You just, you know, it's just somebody brainwashed you to make you think you're in the library today. But, you know, it's just your imagination playing tricks on you. I mean, you know, there's no way I can convince you that you're not sitting in the library right now, right? Well, it's the same thing with a Scientologist who remembers being, you know, whoever they were in the year 1800. You know, that memory is as real as you remembering that you're in the library right now. So how do you convince somebody that they're wrong? You know, and that's why they become so fanatical in their beliefs. It just, in their minds, it becomes so real. So after these interrogation sessions, a Scientologist will very often confess things that they never did. They'll often feel relieved to get it off their chest. And this makes the Scientologist more likely to cooperate with the ethics officer, who will then encourage the Scientologist to undertake the ethics formulas to increase their ethics condition. And the ethics formulas are designed to coerce the Scientologist into becoming more dedicated than they were before, right? So as these reincarnation memories are being cemented in your brain, and as you start to believe that Scientology has given you this power to live forever and to remember all your past lives, you're going to become more and more dedicated than you were before. And, of course, these ethics formulas are extraordinarily coercive. I mean, one of the ethics formulas requires the Scientologist to decide what group they want to belong to, okay? So, for instance, if a Scientologist decided to skip a day of Scientology coursework to do an audition, an acting audition, the ethics formula would ask the Scientologist to choose between being in the Scientology group or the audition group. And the ethics formula does not allow the Scientologist to choose both, right? You have to select one group at the expense of the other. And so naturally, what they're doing is trying to force you to make choices to cut off those aspects of your life that Scientology doesn't want you to still have as part of your life. And Scientology is striving to make the Scientologist afraid of the outside world. You know, anyone who's critical of Scientology will be labeled as a suppressive person. You know, they'll be labeled a PTS. You know, if you're connected to a suppressive person, you're a PTS. You got to disconnect from the suppressive person to advance in Scientology. And so it's very, very coercive, designed to, you know, whatever your previous life goals were, whatever your dreams were, if it's not about making more money for Scientology, it's not the right thing. It's not the right choice. And so the people are coerced into making these choices where Scientology becomes everything in their life that is important. And so where does this all lead? Well, so these five things I just told you about, the auditing, the TRs, the study tech, the disconnection, and the ethics cycles, these are five things that are reinforced throughout a Scientologist's career. And the Scientologist's career basically involves moving up this bridge. This is the bridge to total freedom, right here. Okay, every Scientologist, I'm sorry, it's not really, let's see if I can hold it up this way. All right. Yeah, well, I don't need that. All right, so the Scientologist career starts at the bottom, and as you can see, there's different levels of enlightenment that a Scientologist is supposed to progress through, okay? Now, the highest level currently available is OT8, which is here. Hubbard supposedly created up to 15, but only OT8 is the highest currently available. Now, the total cost to go from the bottom of the bridge through each level up to OT8, the total cost is approximately $380,000. Now, that's approximately because at various points, they can say to you, you know what, you don't seem like you've got all the benefits you were supposed to get. You need to repeat a level, and you have to pay for it again. So it can end up costing, an infinite amount of money, depending on how many times they make you repeat things over and over and over again. So the goal of a Scientologist is to work their way up that bridge, and I just want to highlight one particular. There's a couple of milestones on the bridge. This is the state of clear. This is when all your engrams have been reduced, and so that's a big milestone to achieve. But after you go clear, then you have to start, addressing all the problems from your past lives, and that's when you start developing these special OT powers. When you get to these OT levels up here, your OT means you're an operating thetan, okay? Thetan, T-H-E-T-A-N, a thetan. You're a thetan. You're not a human being. You're a thetan, okay? And an operating thetan has supernatural abilities. You can control when and where you're going to be born again in a future lifetime. You remember all your past lifetimes. You can astro travel across the universe. And Scientology centers are filled with all kinds of success stories from people who supposedly have had these experiences. And they might have had the experiences in their mind under hypnosis, but they didn't actually have the experience in the physical world. But like I say, Scientologists have a hard time telling the difference a lot of times. So the next milestone is OT3. OT3 is called the Wall of Fire. And if you find out the secret of OT3 before you're ready for it, it can kill you. So the secret is very heavily guarded. When you do OT3, you actually have to go into a locked room with a security guard outside, and you get a special pair of keys, and you get the keys to unlock the materials, and you sit at the table. When you're done, you lock it back up, and then you leave, and the security guard checks you out. And it's a very, very tightly controlled process. Fortunately, somebody did manage to smuggle out one of these OT3 things at one point, which is how we know that's the story of Xenu and the intergalactic evil tyrant Xenu. And basically, Xenu is basically he had an overpopulation problem. So he gathered up all of these alien beings and sent them to planet Tigiak, which is Earth, and dropped them in volcanoes and blew them up with hydrogen bombs. And the remnants of all these alien beings clustered together to form what we now perceive today as being our human bodies. So our bodies are made up of these clusters of body thetans. Okay? So Xenu and the body thetans is what you learn about in OT3. Now, let's just think about this for a second. You're in Scientology, okay? You have known about OT3 without knowing the substance of it. You've known it's a level you want to achieve for years and years. You're in 10 years, 15 years. You spent $300,000 or so. You've mortgaged your home. Your wife thinks you're crazy, so she's left you. Your kids aren't talking to you anymore. Everyone thinks you're nuts, but you've given up your whole life and hours. You've given up all your hobbies and anything else you ever cared about. And all you've done for the past 10 years is go to Scientology. When you get back from work, you go to the Scientology Center. You're there till 11 o'clock every night, Monday to Friday. You come in on the weekends, Saturday and Sunday. You're there all the time. all because you want to get up to this OT3 level. You then get up to the level, you're out there, the security guard lets you in, finally, I'm here, I've made it, I've got salvation. You unlock the thing, you put it in front of you, and you read it, and it's the story of Xenu and the body things. Now, at that point, you got a couple of choices. You can kill yourself. I mean, I know it's funny, people laugh, but it's actually true. That's actually, a lot of people end up committing suicide at this point. You can kill yourself. You can walk away and say, this is nonsense, I don't believe in this anymore. That is actually, there's a number of people who, have told me, they left Scientology the day they saw OT3. They just turned around and walked out. They figured out right then and there this was a scam. But let's think about this for a second. Where are you going to go, right? I mean, your whole life, for the last 10 years, 15 years, is Scientology. All your friends are Scientologists. They're not allowed to talk to you once you become a suppressive person, and when you leave, you're a suppressive person. So you're now going to lose all your friends. You're going to lose your family if your family's in it. If your family's not in it, they probably think you're crazy. And are they still even waiting for you to come back home? I mean, are they still even, trying? If you have a loving family that's going to welcome you back, great. If you have a family that's written you off, as many people do, where are you going to go, right? I mean, if you have somewhere to go, okay. But a lot of people have nowhere to go, which leads to the other two choices. Kill yourself. Or the third choice is, hey, I'm going to start talking to my body thetans and see if I can move to OT4 by confronting my body thetans. And so that's what happens. You're under hypnosis, you're highly suggestible, and you start hallucinating these little alien beings crawling on your body, and you start having conversations with them, and when you're convinced that they've gone away, you can now, do the steps you need to get to the next level and to go to OT4. And just in case you're wondering, Tom Cruise and John Travolta reportedly are at the OT7 level. So they've done this, reportedly. I don't have any personal knowledge of that, but that's... So by the time a person is seeing alien beings crawling on their arms, they're psychotic. They have a mental illness at that point. I mean, it's a mental illness induced by your environment as opposed to a mental illness being induced by, a chemical deficiency or genetic disease or whatever it is. Nevertheless, it's still a mental illness. And again, I think this distinguishes a destructive cult from a non-destructive cult. I mean, I was raised in the Jewish religion, and, I certainly don't believe, as a skeptic now, I don't believe in the parting of the Red Sea and all the stuff I was told, but I never hallucinated it while I was in the Jewish religion. This really causes psychological damage to people. It causes financial damage to people. I mean, Scientology is really, really messes people up. It really messes them up. So here I am. I'm in Scientology, and I'm in it for 6 months, and I was getting more and more into it. I never got to the OT3 level, never even got to be clear. But they did ask me to join something called the Sea Organization. Okay, that's Sea as in S-E-A, as in the ocean, okay? Because L. Ron Hubbard was being kicked out of every country he went to, and the only place he could find, where he was safe was in international water. So he set up the Scientology headquarters on a boat and went out to sea. Therefore, it's the Sea Organization. Now, the Sea Organization, in the 1970s, the Sea Organization landed back in Clearwater, Florida, and they set up a land base. They now have land bases all over the world, but they still call it the Sea Organization. And the Sea Organization is set up like a military unit. They have ranks, and they have military uniforms, and they dress with the lanyards, and the leaders have the scrambled eggs on their hats, or whatever those things are called. It looks very official and very militaristic. Well, after I was in for 6 months, and at this point, I had taken a job working for them. Basically what happened was I didn't have the money to keep paying for the courses. So they said, if you work for us, we'll give you the courses for free. So I started working at the Long Island Scientology Center. And of course, I didn't have time to do all the free courses because I was so busy working. But what happened was my agenda started to change. Once I was working for them, previously I'd been going once or twice a week. Now I'm working for them. Every day I'm there. And in that environment, my agenda started to change. I started realizing it's kind of selfish for me to just try to get myself to go clear. I have to be helping everyone else go clear around the world, right? If they had told me 6 months earlier, that they wanted me to become a recruiter and try to help bring in other people into the organization. I was, no way, I'm not interested. I just took a personality test. I was looking to improve my life. I didn't like the way my life was going. But I wasn't looking to go around saving the rest of the world. But now, after having been in it, suddenly, hey, that seems like a good idea. I want to save the rest of the world, right? So now I'm going out to Roosevelt Field Mall and handing out personality tests, and people are making fun of me and spitting at me and everything else. And I'm like, determined. That just makes me more determined, you know. So after 6 months, the Sea Org called me up, and they wanted me to take a job working for them. You know, I'm not even clear yet, but the Sea Org was telling me how special I am and how important I am, how much they need me. And the thing with the Sea Org is, unlike the Long Island Center where I was working, in the Sea Org, you actually live with them as well. So basically, they wanted me to drop out of college and move in to their compound in Manhattan on 48th Street and live and work with them full time. Okay? And the Sea Org members get paid at the time, it was about $35 a week. You get one day off every 2 weeks. If you're good, if your ethics are up, if you're in a high ethics condition, if you're in a low ethics condition, you may lose the one day off that you're entitled to. And so they wanted me to do this. And I didn't... And the other catch, which I forgot to mention, you have to sign a 1 billion year employment contract. By the way, because you're going to live forever, right? We're going to give you everything you need to get to these high OT levels. You're going to have immortality. You're going to live forever. So I didn't want to do it, and you know, the billion years didn't scare me because I believed in Scientology at the time, so the billion years actually makes sense, right? If you believe you're going to live forever with Scientology, then the billion years isn't really scary. What bothered me was I didn't want to drop out of school. You know, that was my hang-up. I'm in college. I don't want to drop out of school. So they sat me down in a room. They had these two people dressed in their military Sea Org uniforms, and they had a man and a woman. And the man was somebody I had previously met in Scientology, so I kind of had a buddy-buddy relationship with him. And then the woman was, you know, extraordinarily beautiful woman. And she was flirting with me and telling me how great it would be if we could be in the Sea Org together. And she was, like, from Louisiana. She had this really charming southern accent, and, you know. And they were working me. Like, you know, there would be times when she would get up and leave, and I'd be alone with the guy, and I'd be bonding with him. And then he'd leave, and she'd come back, and then... You know, and they were just working me. This went on for 5 hours, and I now know that the woman had been at the Long Island Center where I worked previously, and so certainly would have had access to my auditing files. When I was talking to them, I was amazed at how much these people seemed to know about me. It was like they could see right into my soul. You know, mystical manipulation. I mean, they had access to my files, right? So, of course, I mean, they say the files are confidential, but obviously they're not. So they're, like, pushing my buttons and getting me to be upset, and then I'd be crying, and then they would calm me down, and then they'd get me to cry again and calm me down. This is torture. This is psychological torture. You know, for 5 hours they're doing this. And now I'm, like, an emotional wreck. You know, my head is spinning. And then they say, because, they you know, I didn't want to drop out of school. So they say, look, suppose you stay in school, and you have a good education, and you get a good job, in 70 years, you're going to be dead. What's the point? 70 years, 50 years, I mean, I was 20 at the time, or 19 at the time. What's the point? You're going to be dead. But if you join us, you'll live forever, right? I mean, we're giving you immortality. Now, that argument may sound ridiculous, you know, sitting here in this library today, but after 5 hours of psychological torture, that argument actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, it really does. I mean, you know, I was already 6 months in Scientology. I already started believed in the basic premises of it. I believed in the reincarnation. I had some kind of weird memories of my own that I thought might be indicative of some memory from earlier. So it starts to make sense. So they put this billion-year contract in front of me, and they put the pen in front of me, and they're both staring at me using the TRs. Sign the contract, Paul. Just sign the contract. Everything will be okay. Just sign the contract. So I picked it up and I signed the contract. And at that point, I dropped out of college, moved into their compound on 48th Street, and my parents went ballistic. They just went nuts. I mean, they had previously been, you know, skeptical about this, but my parents' initial reaction when they first heard I was involved with Scientology was, it's just a phase. He'll get over it. My father even lent me some money to take a course for him. The sooner he does the course, the sooner he'll realize it's a scam. And you know, trying to be supportive, but then, you know, realized, wait a minute, this is a lot more serious than we thought. And then when I dropped out of school, my parents just went ballistic. So I'm working in the Sea Org, and my job there was basically, you know, cleaning toilets 14 hours a day and scrubbing floors, because every person who joins the Sea Org has to go through this initial hazing process. So I was involved in that initial hazing process for a while, and I was feeling kind of miserable. Like, is this what I dropped out of school for? I have to do this for a billion years? But then you look at the leaders in the Sea Org, and you realize, well, they all started cleaning toilets too, and eventually, you know, I'll get to work my way up and do something more prestigious. They were telling me that they wanted to send me out to California. There was a brand new course that was coming out. It's kind of weird, because Hubbard had died in 86, and this was 1990. But a new Hubbard course was coming out, and they were going to send me out to California to get training in this brand new course. So I was all excited about that. And my parents said, look, before you go to California, we just want to take you out to dinner. And I said, no, I don't have time. I don't have time. You know? And they said, no, we got to take you out to dinner. I said, I don't have time. So my parents confronted the leader of Scientology, the president of the New York Church, John Carmichael. They confronted him in the lobby of the Sea Org building and demanded that they be allowed to see me. This was on a Sunday night, and they demanded they be allowed to see me on the next Wednesday. And Carmichael was resisting, and my parents had gotten really smart really fast. Basically, just to give you an idea of the time frame, it was on a Wednesday that I told my parents I was dropping out of school. On Thursday, my parents got the number for a Cult Information Service. It's an organization in Teaneck, New Jersey, of, you know, cult experts. So I told them I was dropping out of school on Wednesday. By Thursday, they got the Cult Information Service number. By the next Wednesday, they were planning to do an intervention to get me out. So this is how fast they were moving. And they were basically planning to do an exit counseling, which is, you might have heard the word deprogramming, but people who do that kind of work don't like to use the word deprogramming. They use the word exit counseling, or some other people use the phrase thought reform consultant. There's a lot of different terms going around. But the bottom line is the exit counselors initially told my parents, we think you're moving a little too fast here. You know, to do an exit counseling, you got to do some planning. You know, you got to do family counseling before you can do the exit counseling, because one of the things that happens in an exit counseling is you get the mother and the father. You know, it's your fault our kid's in a cult. It's your fault the kid's in a cult. And then the cult member can divide the family up, and the whole thing blows up. So the exit counselors were saying to my parents, you got to take time to do family counseling first. You're not ready to do an exit counseling. So my dad calls up my mother at work and says, honey, are you responsible for our kid being in a cult? She goes, no. She goes, am I responsible for our kid being in a cult? She goes, no. So he hangs up the phone, calls back the exit counselor and says, we just had family counseling. Let's move. So they were worried that I was going to go out to California, and they didn't know if they'd ever see me again. So they felt like they had to move. So now my dad's negotiating with the president of Scientology to agree to take me out to dinner on that Wednesday, and the guy's resisting. And my dad had learned some of the terminology of Scientology at this point. For instance, Scientology has what they call a fair game policy. Okay, anybody who attacks Scientology is fair game. And fair game may be tricked, sued, lied to, or destroyed by any Scientologist without any discipline of the Scientologist. Okay, that's the fair game policy. So my dad obviously can't make a death threat to John Carmichael, because he would call the police and get my father arrested. So my father said, Carmichael, if I don't see my kid Wednesday, you're fair game. And Carmichael knew what that meant, right? He's like, oh, fair game, uh-oh. I'm in trouble now. So basically my dad learned to talk to them in their own language, right? And that intimidated him, and he agreed to let me go have dinner with my parents on Wednesday night. He told me, Carmichael told me, that I should only spend 45 minutes with my parents and then come right back, go to a restaurant down the street, come right back. But Carmichael didn't tell that to my parents, right? So when my parents showed up, you know, my aunt was there, my dad's sister, and she's like the type of person who could just talk your ear off. And before I know it, you know, she's like, oh, hi, Paul, how you doing? Love you. See, because the Scientologist had programmed me to believe that my parents were suppressive people, but they had never said anything about my aunt, because my aunt, you know, my aunt hadn't really been involved in criticizing any of this, and my best friend Matt also had been kind of supportive of me the whole time. So my aunt shows up, and she's like distracting me, and next thing you know, I'm in the car, and we're driving away. And at some point, I realized, you know, they only wanted me to spend 45 minutes with you. I think I need to go back. And my parents said, wait a second. We didn't have a deal. We had a deal to spend the night with you. We didn't have a 45-minute curfew. And so then I started, like, resisting my parents. I was like, you're kidnapping me. Let me go. My dad's like, look, you're free to go. It's just by that point, we were going 60 miles an hour on the Long Island Expressway. It's like, you know, if we get to our destination and you want to leave, you can leave. But I can't drop you off on the side of the highway. So we get to a hotel out in Hapag, Long Island. And so my aunt is there. My parents are there. And my best friend Matt was there. And the reason I didn't leave is because when I got there, I saw Matt was there. And I was thinking, oh, great. Now they're going to get Matt, like, sucked into this. And then Matt's going to become a suppressive person. So my initial reaction was, I got to stay here just to save, you know, Matt, my best friend, right? And so he was able to convince me to stay. And we sat down. They had these four exit counselors there. I felt like I was walking into an ambush, you know? And so I was ready to use all of my Scientology training. I had been bull baited like 2 days before this, you know, because the Scientologist knew I was going to dinner with my parents and they thought something might be up. So they did the bull baiting exercise with me where I have to sit there and they're attacking me. And so when the exit counselor started talking, I was just, you know, nothing got through. And there were two exit counselors there who were former members of a group called EST, which is now called Landmark Forum. And the problem there is Scientology, the guy who started EST was a former Scientologist, and Scientology had already told me that EST was an evil organization, but some guy who ripped off Scientology. So I didn't believe anything that they had to say. But the other two exit counselors were former Scientologists, and these were the first people I had ever met who spoke in the Scientology language but were not loyal to Scientology. So right away, there's a connection there. I was able to talk to them, and I could tell they knew what they were talking about because they knew the language, right? This goes to show how important that language criteria is that Robert Lifton talks about, that I was able to get through to them. And one of the exit counselors was a young guy. He was a former Scientologist, just a few years older than me. So I really connected with him. And they started showing me videos about Scientology, and they started giving me documents and showing me all this stuff and trying to, you know, educate me. And, you know, I was fighting back as much as I could. Finally, they pull out the OT3 document. And this is very interesting because my memory of this and everyone else's memory is very different. My memory of this is they pull out the OT3 document, and I didn't want to play this game. I mean, I knew whatever they're showing me, I have no way of being able to prove whether this is really the OT3 thing, whether this is the Xenu story. They're claiming the Xenu story is OT3. I have no way of knowing that. I can't prove that. So I have no power here. I have these people in telling me that that's what it is, but how can I prove them wrong? I'm like, there's no point in even arguing it because I have no resources to act on. So I didn't want to play the game. I don't want to look at this. I don't want to talk to you about it. You know, you're just setting me up, and I was just resentful of the whole thing. That's my memory of it. Everyone else who was in the room swears that I turned white as a ghost. I was scared out of my mind. I was, like, terrified to look at OT3. Because Scientology says if you see OT3 before you're ready, it will kill you. So, you know, I was hypnotized to be afraid of it, right? I don't remember being afraid of it. It just goes to show how hypnosis works, is that the person being hypnotized can rationalize what's going on, that I was exhibiting a fear response. I was afraid to look at it, but I had a perfectly good justification for not wanting to look at it, as far as I could tell. But, you know, so the mind control worked in the sense that I refused to look at it. Whether it worked because I was actually afraid I was going to die or whether it worked because I just didn't want to play their game, it doesn't really matter. The point is my mind did what the cult leaders wanted me to do, you know. So it's just a very interesting insight into how the mind control works. So anyway, my best friend Matt grabbed the OT3 doctrine and just started reading it out loud to me. You know, so basically I ended up hearing about Xenu and the body thetans. And I agreed to stay overnight in this hotel. And the next morning, we continued some more. And by about 2 o'clock the next day, I decided I had enough. I don't want to hear any more of this. I decided I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go back to Scientology. So they tried, you know, my friend Matt and this one exit counselor followed me to the train station and tried to talk me to come back for another hour. And I said, no, absolutely not. And when I got on the train, I looked back at Matt, you know, and I waved goodbye to him. And the look on his face, it just really hit me because, you know, I had never seen him this upset. But he just had this look of absolute despair on his face to the point where he tried to wave goodbye to me and couldn't even get his hand all the way up. He kind of waved goodbye like this. Like, he couldn't even do a real wave. And that really stuck with me the whole train ride back into the city. Because now something's wrong here. I mean, Scientology is supposed to, you know, solve your problems and improve your life, improve your relationships. So why is it the people I care about are so upset? Something was wrong here, but I couldn't put my finger on it. When I got back to the cult, I was debriefed by John Carmichael. And I told him everything that had happened. I told him that I had, you know, they told me this thing about Xenu and all that. And John Carmichael's an OT7. So even though I didn't believe I had seen the real OT3 materials, he knew that I had seen the real OT3 materials. And obviously, that makes me a security threat now, right? To have me in Scientology knowing about Xenu, if I start telling people, these people tried to convince me that OT3 was Xenu. Can you imagine that? You know, if I had that conversation with all the other Scientologists, that would just have been a disaster. Carmichael is obviously getting concerned that I'm a security risk now. I also started asking a lot of questions, though. See, here's the thing. The exit counselors did not convince me to leave Scientology, but they put a lot of questions into my head. You know, how come they never talked to you about Elmer Hubbard's family, right? This stuff like help is supposed to help your family life. How come did you ever hear about Elmer Hubbard's family in all the biographies and all the books written about Hubbard and all the pictures of Hubbard? Do you ever see a family member in those pictures? Do you ever hear? Why not? How come? The exit counselors were asking me this. How come? I'm like, I don't know. You know, maybe he wants to keep his family private. I don't know. Well, you know, one of my exit counselors happened to have been good friends with Quentin Hubbard, Hubbard's son, who at the age of 19 committed suicide. Sort of calls into question the validity of Scientology when the leader's son kills himself. So, and of course, he was a bigamist. You know, his first two wives had accused him of beating them. I was asking all these questions, and I could tell Carmichael was very, very nervous with these questions I was asking. But then I think the thing that really tipped the scales here was before I had left the exit counseling, the last thing my dad had said to me before I left was he said, look, you're a grown man now. You're 19 years old. You make your own decisions. I can't tell you what to do. If you want to go back to Scientology, then you go back. But you need to understand something. Your mother and I are going to tell everybody about this. And for every person you recruit, we're going to keep 10 people out. Right? That's what my dad said to me. And he said that knowing that I'm a human tape recorder, right? As soon as I get back to Carmichael, Carmichael's asking me, did your parents threaten to do anything to the church? Did they threaten to attack us? Did they threaten anything? And I'm like, hemming and hawing. Well, they didn't say they were going to attack you. They didn't say, what'd they say? And so I said, well, they said that for every person I recruit, they're going to keep 10 people out. They're going to tell everybody about this. They're going to tell all the politicians about this. They're going to go to the news media. They're going to do that, you know. And Carmichael, and there was another woman in the room, too, and the woman, her head just went into her hands, like, ugh, that's it. You know, that's it. I was declared a PTS type A and disconnected from the church and officially kicked out and sent home. So the exit counseling ended up working with a 24-hour delay. I went home. I went back to Scientology for 24 hours, and they got kicked out, and they got sent back home. So when I got back home, naturally, I'm pissed off at my parents now for getting me kicked out. And so my parents eventually got me to see, like, you know, other counselors that I was able to talk to. And my parents were very smart about it. And, of course, they were acting on the advice of, you know, experts who told them what to do. But they, you know, instead of confronting me about Scientology, they would just leave things around the house so that I would read it when no one was around. Because a lot of this was pride. You know, 19-year-old doesn't want to admit to his parents, you know, I made a mistake, you know. So a lot of this was just pride. But on my own, I was able to read stuff and sort of got myself to the point where I knew that Scientology was a hoax. And at that point, you know, at that point, I began a grieving process. You know, at that point, it was, you know, huge despair at that point, because now, you know, you think you're going to live forever and you've got this incredible thing and then suddenly it's gone. I entered a grieving process. So I was only in Scientology for about 6 months. It took me about a full year to really completely recover from it, to really understand what had happened and to really feel better about it. It was really, you know, so it had a really big psychological impact on me. And that was only having been in it for 6 months. Now imagine, people are in this for 10 years, 20 years. I only spent about $1,000 because I was in college and didn't have any other money. People have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in this, and it's 20 years of their life, and then they come out and they've got nothing. Now, how do you put on a resume that I was in Scientology for 20 years? You know, I mean, this really messes up people's lives. But I did recover from it. I eventually started speaking out about it. And, you know, at first I was speaking out about it because I became an RA. I went back to school, became an RA, and I had to do an educational program as an RA, and I decided to do cults. And then I got such positive feedback from it, and I realized nobody else is talking about cults. They're all, you know, there's tons of programs on drugs and date rape, and those are all important issues, and certainly it's a good thing that they have all those programs. But most colleges don't do a cult program in freshman orientation. You know, it's not required in freshman orientation that you do a cult program, but I think it should be. So I started doing a lot more of these, and I've done a couple of interventions myself, and I've gotten some people out, fortunately. But basically now, you know, since leaving Scientology, I've gone to law school. I graduated Brooklyn Law School, magna cum laude. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying it to make a point. You know, the point being that people assume that people who get involved in cults are idiots or dummies. You know, I'll admit, signing a billion-year contract for Scientology was not the smartest thing I've ever done. But I was only dumb while I was in Scientology. You know, before that, I was an honor student in high school. And then after that, I graduated law school magna cum laude. So, you know, I was only an idiot while I was in the cult. You know, cults don't recruit stupid people. Cults make people stupid. So now I'm a personal injury lawyer, and I am dying to get a Scientologist who can bring me a case. But unfortunately, most people don't realize, most people come out of this, they're messed up. And they're not in any condition to even talk to a lawyer until 3 or 4 years after they're out, and the statute of limitations has run. So, you know, just as a lawyer, I would like to see, in addition to seeing, you know, Robert Lifton's criteria recognized as, you know, a basis for a cause of action, I'd also like to see statutes of limitations adjusted to account for people who have been subjected to mind control in a cult, a long time of recovery before they're in a position to really come to terms with what happened. And the 3-year limitations period that applies to an ordinary tort it's not appropriate for a mind control situation. But if anybody has any any cases you want to talk to me about, please feel free. I'm going to turn it over to questions in just a few minutes, but before I do, I just want to just very briefly give us some ideas of what you can do and what you should be on the lookout for. In terms of preventing yourself from being recruited into a cult, you know, you want to remember, and these are all the same things that as skeptics, you probably already have heard this many times before, you know, nothing is free. If somebody's offering you something, there's probably a catch to it. Don't go along with someone just because they say, you know, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You know, once-in-a-lifetime opportunities come along every day. So always be skeptical. I mean, don't be seduced by strangers who shower you with love or instant friendship. You know, don't give in to peer pressure. You know, ask lots of questions whenever you meet a new group or someone asks you for money. Be aware of the big warning sign. If you ask a question and they say, don't worry, you'll find out later. No, I want to know now. If you can't tell me now, I don't want to be in your group. Okay? Always be willing to ask questions. Don't trust anybody who doesn't allow questions to be asked of them. Be willing to say no. Be willing to be assertive. And conduct an assessment of yourself. I mean, ask yourself, if something were to happen in your life that would make you vulnerable, what would you do? Who would you turn to? What contingency plans do you have if you lose your job? I mean, we're in a bad economy now. If you get laid off, make sure you have a contingency plan or some support system that you can lean on so that the Scientology offer or the Mooney's offer is not going to sound like the most attractive option that you have. And finally, if you know somebody who is involved in a destructive cult, what should you do? You want to be careful you don't want to come right out and say, it's a cult, you know, because that's going to be the kind of thing that's going to make you a suppressive person or satanic or... You know, you want to keep the lines of communication open. That's the most important thing. Keep the lines of communication open. Do what my parents did. Put questions in the person's mind without taking sides. You know, I respect your decision to be a member of that group, but I'm just wondering, what about this? And what about this? And have you And how does the leader explain this? You know, ask questions that will cause the person to think critically about what they're doing without necessarily being hostile. And it's not always easy to do that. Sometimes the mere question itself automatically sounds hostile by the nature of the question. It's not always easy to do. But you know, if you get together with cult experts, they can often help craft a script. You know, cult experts can often help you craft a script that you can use in certain situations. You want to document everything. If someone you know is in a cult, you want to document everything. Collect items from newspapers, magazines, or websites that have information about the leader. Network with other former members of the group and other loved ones who have members in the group. Don't give any money to the person in the group because that money is just going to end up with the cult leader. And don't give up. You know, the person that you love is a product of your love, and no matter how much mind control is used, a person's love for you is never going to be truly eliminated by any psychological technique. You know, the real personality is still there, so don't ever give up. Well, that's all I have, and if you have questions, I'll open it up.
This has been a presentation of New York City Skeptics. To learn more about New York City Skeptics and for information about our upcoming activities and events, please visit us at nycskeptics.org. Thank you for listening.